Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. BP moves up its target date for capping the well. The embattled oil giant is also using a charm offensive as it tries to save its fiscal health. The Justice Department sues Arizona to stop its immigration law, and prominent Republicans call for RNC Chair Michael Steele's resignation after his gaffe in the war on Afghanistan. Joining us in the studio for the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup, Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, Shayla Murray of the Washington Post, and John Dickerson of Slate.com. I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments throughout the hour. 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning and happy Friday, everybody.
Good morning, Diane.
More bad news for the economy this week. John Dickerson.
Well, that's right. Retail sales are they're sluggish. They're up, but they're not what people would hope, which is kind of the same thing we got last week with the jobs number. 83,000 private sector jobs up, not down. That's good, but a lot more sluggish than people would hope for in an economy. And so it's another, blow for the White House, which is trying to find anything it can find to show that the economy is doing better.
And that's the question, Shayla. Does the administration have any more tools to help the economy?
Well, they certainly don't have much in the way of spending anymore. You see that that well drying up in Congress. Democrats don't want to spend any more money in large sums. There just isn't any in the deficit. The fear of deficit spending, I think, has started to eclipse, and that stimulus really hasn't taken hold among voters, although a lot of economists think it has had a great effect, especially in some regions. You saw the White House pivot this week to exports and turning to some of these trade agreements that have been on the shelf for quite a while. You could argue that this is the last thing they have left, last option they have left on the table. It's also sort of a longer-term strategy that may benefit President Obama's reelection more than Democrats running in the midterms.
Naftali, how much of that stimulus money has actually been spent?
Well, a good deal of it's actually been spent. And as Shayla says, if you talk to most economists, they would probably say that it's had a positive effect. But for whatever reason, that's not something that is necessarily taken hold in the public imagination. And so politically, the White House faces a situation where the public believes that the economy hasn't really turned around, and it certainly hasn't turned around as vigorously as people had hoped. And political scientists often say that this is right around the time when the perception of the public takes hold, so that even if the economy were to skyrocket in the next 4 months, it might be too late for the Democrats to have a better showing in the midterms.
And this is why we're seeing President Obama move his way around the country in the last few weeks, stopping in Kansas City yesterday and in Las Vegas today to talk about some of these stimulus projects. There was he was at an electric truck factory yesterday in Kansas City that received about a $30 million federal grant. And those kind of projects, the administration argues, have a large impact locally, but they have a communications problem. And so much of economics stability is about confidence and about people believing that things are changing. And Democrats have just not put that together yet.
The other thing we saw the White House doing is the president held an event, as you mentioned, Diane, on exports and heralded the fact that exports were up 17% over the year before. And that was good news. And the president had pledged in his State of the Union address 5 months ago to double exports. And he was sort of trying to suggest, although not exactly suggesting, that his pledge had created the 17-point increase. In fact, that wasn't the case. The 17% increase has come from the recovery as it's kind of bounced along. But you see the White House trying to kind of find the best piece of news it can find in these otherwise dismal numbers and kind of back an event into celebrating whatever they can find to celebrate on the numbers front.
Yeah, and they're also sort of groping at ways other than federal spending that they can perhaps create more jobs. I mean, the big problem right now in terms of public reception, I think in terms of reality, is the job situation. And they can't spend more money. They probably think they should, and many economists think they should, but politically, that just isn't going to work anymore. So they're talking about things like exports. They're also talking about things like business investment. They feel like businesses are sitting on a lot of money right now that they could go out there and spend, and that would create jobs. They're looking for things other than spending. They have this whole initiative this summer called Recovery Summer. Which is an interesting name because it harkens back to Freedom Summer and things like that that involved civil rights issues and arguably much larger moral issues. But in any case, they do keep on running into this problem where they dub this Recovery Summer, and then the numbers that come out don't seem quite to justify that name.
So what it really comes down to, it seems to me, is this question between more stimulus creating a larger deficit or creating jobs, and that debate is still going on.
It's still going on. It'll be going on after the election when the president's deficit commission comes forward. It will be probably the issue of 2012. The problem for the president, of course, is that he believes that short-term stimulus is necessary, but politically people are terrified of the deficit, so there's a disconnect. And just to Naftali's point about business, you do one thing that was striking about the president's comments is he really sort of was boosting business. There's been a lot of bashing of AIG, of the banks, of the Wall Street banks. And you heard the president say, hey, you know, this export story is part of the vibrancy of American business, kind of boosting business out there to show not only that things are going well, but also to kind of give a pat to the back to business, because business is on the sidelines, worried about federal regulation, worried about this constant bashing from Washington, which means they can't make economic decisions.
But what about Shayla's point that it's Democrats who are holding this up? Isn't it equally Republican, Shayla?
It is. And what you see in Congress right now is a complete lack of consensus on how to move forward. And a lot of smart politicians knowing and feeling that they need to do something and yet having no tools or inadequate tools that aren't guaranteed of working. You'll see this debate play out this week when the Senate attempts to pass yet another extension of unemployment benefits. Economists will tell you that that's one of the most effective means of stimulating the economy because it's money that goes to people who need it and it is spent right away. And yet a number of Democrats in the House have voted against that extension, and they're going to just scrape by in the Senate this week just to extend the benefits to December. And that's because, again, of this deficit concern and the concern that people think that, yes, while they want Congress to help lead the country, you know, do what it can to lead the country out of this mess, it also wants Congress to manage the government more efficiently. So they're kind of caught in that crosshairs.
And leaving the politics aside, we're engaged, I think, in an unusually pure way in this debate about whether the best way forward is through government spending or through keeping the deficit down. This is a debate that Franklin Roosevelt had, and we usually don't see it in this kind of pure form. But we're at this very critical juncture in the recovery where we're moving in the right direction, but we're not there yet. And so the question is, do we just need a little more spending to get ourselves over the hump, or do we need to cut back out of fear that the deficit will torpedo the whole thing?
One other player in this is the Fed, of course, and there's reports this week that the Fed is trying to figure out what else it may be able to do. Rates are already at zero, but they
right.
would say, no, really, they're going to stay at zero. In other words, send a message that rates aren't going to change. The key for the Fed was deciding when to maybe inch rates up as a guard against inflation. Now, with the economy looking stalled, the idea would be the Fed would send some kind of message to say rates are going to stay low now. The other bigger option they could do would be to do an asset purchase program like they did during the really tough part of the recovery. They purchased about $1.7 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities and that kind of thing. That's being being held off for the moment, but that's the other big kind of lever. The question is whether it would be as effective now as it was in 2009 when they used it to bolster the economy.
So you've got economists on both sides of this issue. Krugman, for example, Paul Krugman, is saying you've got to move ahead with more stimulus. You've got to help out these people who are unemployed. Do you move in that direction, or do you follow those who say you cannot increase the deficit now?
Well, that's the debate. What Paul Krugman, I think, would say would be put the money out now and then be serious about deficit reduction. The problem for both of them is that for both sides of this debate is that the people who have to be serious about deficit reduction are the public and the politicians, and neither one shows an appetite for seriousness. There's a Pew poll out last week in which people were asked, if the states have to cut their budgets to pay for these shortfalls, how should they do it? And everybody agreed the states should cut. And then when you ask them, okay, should they cut education? No. Should they cut the police? No. Should they cut X? No. Why? No. People have no appetite for the things that need to be cut in order to take care of these deficits.
Yeah, I mean, that's a key political point that applies at the federal level as well. I mean, everybody agrees in theory that the deficit should be cut, but if it were that easy, you know, people would have done it. I mean, one of the big things that has to be done is a look at Social Security and Medicare. That's where a lot of the spending comes from. But whether it's that or other things, people can. And this pattern, again, is one that's been going on for a long time. People in theory favor cuts in spending, but have great difficulty naming anything that would make a difference that they think should be cut.
What about tax cuts?
Well, I mean, tax cuts remain popular. There's a debate coming up because the Bush tax cuts are going to sunset, and people sort of are focusing on whether or not that they should be extended. But there's a reason that those tax cuts were made temporary to begin with and had a sunset provision, because the Bush administration didn't want to forecast deficits going way out into the future. So they created these tax cuts that would end, I think, believing that at some point they'd be extended.
Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, Shayla Murray, she's a reporter for the Washington Post. John Dickerson is chief political correspondent for Slate.com. Your calls when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back. With me for this week's hour of the Friday News Roundup, Shayla Murray of the Washington Post, John Dickerson. He's the author of My Mother, Nancy Dickerson, and the title of that book is On Her Trail. Naftali Ben-David is national correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and author of The Thumpin', How Rahm Emanuel and the Democrats Learned to Be Ruthless and Ended the Republican Revolution. I'm going to go to Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and open the phones. Good morning, Sylvia.
Good morning. I love your show.
Thank you.
I just want to make a comment on what many of the federal government or politicians do not understand. And if they don't understand, they don't care. I am 65. I brought up my two children on my own, put myself through college, graduated with honors. And I am 65. Nobody will hire me. Now I've been told I won't have any more federal help. And because I have to retire early, I'm losing out on extra funds. And the fact that they're not giving out any more federal help, there will be, I guarantee there will be more crime. There will be a tremendous amount of people, families, on the street. Landlords around here and probably everywhere else, they do not care.
Sylvia, let me ask you a question, if I may. You said you're at the end of your federal help. Do you mean unemployment compensation?
Federal stimulus tiers.
Pardon me?
The stimulus tiers that they were helping people because I had no more unemployment. Because I've been employed for so long.
I see. Now, you do have medical help.
Well, here's my problem with medical. They're with the retiring early, they'll be taking out $100 and some odd just for A and B. I have to now depend on my husband, his job, to get pharmacy. Because I'm diabetic, I have many problems,
and I see
it costs quite a bit, and so I have to use that part out of my husband's money that we pay for him. Now,
Sylvia is not alone, John Dickerson.
No, she's not. I mean, the Senate failed once again last week to restore those jobless benefits for people who've been out of work, and this will be debated again when they come back. There was a second portion of that legislation that dealt with incentives to revive the housing market, but the housing market is quite different than what Sylvia's problem is.
Sure. Go ahead, Sheila.
Well, this goes back to what we were discussing earlier, which is that the real problem is the lack of jobs, and that unemployment benefits have been extended to about 99 weeks now. And at a certain point, people need to find work. And Sylvia is looking for a job and can't seem to find one.
And at 65, it's probably very
the
difficult.
The deck is stacked against you.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, that is really what the essence of the problem and the challenge is creating jobs all across, for young people who also can't find work graduating from college, all the way up to Sylvia who are at retirement age, don't necessarily want to stop working.
Well, I certainly hope that members of Congress might have heard Sylvia's call, because as we all know, she's not alone. Good luck to you, Sylvia. I hope you are in touch with your own representative in Rhode Island, and indeed the governor there. Here's an email from Robin in Frederica, Delaware. She says, isn't worrying about the deficit now during this economic downturn like worrying about your furniture getting wet while the fire department is putting out the fire in your house? Naftali.
Well, I mean, it's a good metaphor. A lot of people might think so. And the interesting thing is that sense prevailed for the first couple years, I guess, year and a half of the recession. And periodically, things would come up in terms of extending unemployment insurance, extending COBRA health benefits, more stimulus spending. And while many Republicans were always opposed to these things, at least if they weren't paid for, they passed, perhaps not easily, but they passed. And now we seem to be this juncture where the public concern about the deficit and the debt is such that it's overtaking these other concerns.
Who is stoking the fire about the deficit spending? There didn't seem to be that kind of concern under the last administration.
Well, that's true. The people did raise it, but it didn't reach this kind of fever pitch. Obviously,
why I'm asking who's stoking the fire.
Well, obviously, this is a big issue with the Tea Party groups. It's one of their perhaps central issues is government spending and deficits, but it's spread beyond that. I mean, I think if you ask people, if you look at polls, it is a concern that people have that's right up there. One of the things that's happening is it is spreading to the Democratic Party. Not the whole Democratic Party, but if you have the Republicans voting against virtually anything that the president or the Democratic leadership proposes, and you have these blue dog Democrats, many of them in very tough conservative districts heading toward an election, they have great con- the Democrats couldn't even come up with a budget resolution this year in the House. You know, traditionally every year there's a budget resolution that passes that goes out 5 years. And this year, because some of the Democrats thought we should be spending more, some thought we should cutting back spending, others just didn't want to put their name to anything that had a deficit on it. And so the Democrats have struggled.
So we come down to politics while people across the country are hurting. Shayla.
And I think that's exactly why people are cynical about Washington, why people are angry with both parties, and why probably more than anything else, worrying about the deficit is about the least productive thing you can do. Because as long as I've been in this town, people have been worrying about the deficit in one form or another, Medicare, Social Security, the baby boomers retiring, and yet neither party has shown any ability to get serious and make the really serious decisions that are needed. I mean, we'll see that this week. There's an interesting hearing before the Senate Finance Committee on the expiring tax breaks. The door is opening on that debate, and the degree to which both parties are willing to face up to the real deficit problem, which is the big looming deficit problem related to, you know, revenue shortfalls.
I think also people are worried about the deficit for a couple of other reasons. There's the example of Greece. People feel like the deficit can get, or the debt can get so large that nobody will, that someday the U.S. will offer treasuries to be purchased and there won't be buyers, and that would have a catastrophic economic effect. There are a lot of people who believe that would never happen. But this is also wrapped up in the idea that China owns a lot of our debt and that worries people. I think also people look at the TARP bailout. They look at the various bailouts and they think, you know, all of this money is being spent and it ain't going to me. And this is both Republicans and Democrats. In the Missouri Senate race, when the president was just out there, the Republican in that race, Roy Blunt, is getting pounded for his corralling votes to vote for the TARP bill by the Democrat. And so in a lot of ways, it's to everybody's advantage to try and stick their opponent with having added to this.
All right. Let's move on to the oil spill. Yesterday, federal appeals court rejected the moratorium on deep water drilling in the Gulf. What is the administration likely to do next, Naftali?
Well, they're going to do two things. They're going to keep on pursuing this case because that was just one step along the way. They imposed a six-month moratorium on deepwater drilling. It was immediately challenged, and federal judges have so far upheld the challenges. But there's still more to go in the court case. But they're also talking about coming up with a more targeted moratorium. It's hard to know exactly what that's going to be, but sooner rather than later, it may target, for example, operators that have a worse safety record. So they're going ahead and moving forward. But, I mean, this goes, in a way, back to our last conversation. So after this enormous spill, they thought it was a rational thing to do to impose a moratorium, but it could have cost a lot of people their jobs. So they're caught in this political vise as well as a sort of policy and substantive one about what they do here when you have this environmental catastrophe on the one hand and people out of work on the other.
And a war in Afghanistan as well.
And this is sort of the classic Washington response, like always fighting the last battle. So they stick a moratorium on oil drilling, and yet can't seem to launch this debate on alternative energy, which the Senate is going to try to do again this month. The president is in Las Vegas today talking about renewable energy. And people, you know, it's another thing like deficit reduction. Everybody's for it, and yet nobody, they can't seem to coalesce around a strategy. And so what you end up with are these responses like this drilling moratorium, which is going to cost a lot of jobs. You know, all this equipment's going to move off into faraway waters, and it will really push us back to the extent that we want to continue drilling.
The governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, has said it's going to cost about 20,000 jobs. Some people put the number at much higher. And the point he makes is that and this kind of goes back to our last conversation, is that you have essentially a de facto moratorium, even though this judge has said that you just can't justify the immeasurable effect on the economy from this legislation, can't justify the safety benefits versus the immeasurable effect on the economy. Uncertainty creates a de facto ban, and this is what corporations are saying. Uncertainty about legislation in Washington on everything from energy to banking freezes everybody, and so there's no activity. And that, so whether you actually have a moratorium in place or not, just that uncertainty puts a real lid on economic activity.
But you've got Bappy Jindal with a split tongue if he's worried about what's happening to his area and calling for the government to do more and more and more, and yet protesting that moratorium.
And he solves that split tongue by blaming the government for not watching over the oil companies well enough and preventing the spills in the first place.
Which, by the way, isn't something the Obama administration disagrees with. I mean, their take on this has been that the Bush administration was very cozy with oil companies, that it didn't impose regulations or scrutiny the way they should have, and that that's a big reason for this.
So now we have the Justice Department suing the state of Arizona over its immigration law. Give us an overview of that law. Naftali.
Of the law itself? Well, the law says a lot of things. For example, it doesn't let individual communities in Arizona be more permissive about immigration than the federal law says. But the most incendiary part of it that's really gotten the attention is the part that says that police officers, if they have contact with anyone and they have reasonable suspicion, and that's the term that's in the law, that the person may be an illegal immigrant, then they have to verify whether or not that person is or isn't. And that's been controversial because a lot of people think it would lead inevitably to racial profiling, to the police going after people who seem to be of Hispanic origin, and President Obama has been very outspoken against it.
And now you've got other states thinking about enacting the same kinds of laws, Shayla.
That's right. Apparently, Utah, South Carolina, and Oklahoma are considering similar laws. Those are three states with conservative majorities that would be a lot of states have considered these laws. Those three states are considered the most likely to impose them. In Oklahoma, you have an effort to go even further by making it a felony. The government would be allowed to seize assets from companies that hire illegal immigrants. That is definitely entering a new realm. But yet, I think it reflects a new reality about immigration and the way people see immigration, a lot of it tied to the violence in Mexico spilling over the borders.
Shayla Murray of The Washington Post. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And John Dickerson, I gather that's going to be a huge campaign issue.
It will be a huge campaign issue, and it's not clear how it cuts that this the Justice Department action to basically say that this Arizona law is unconstitutional and to stop it from going into effect on the 29th of July. In some places, in some Senate races, and particularly Harry Reid's, maybe in Nevada, the idea is that this Democratic action will increase Hispanic vote participation for the Democrats. That might also benefit candidates in Colorado and California. Lots of other Democrats would say no, just the opposite. It energizes Republicans who think about this as a state's rights issue. They are already significantly exercised about immigration, and the majority of this country supports the Arizona legislation. Conservative Republicans support it quite a lot, too, but they also see this as the federal government meddling in two ways. One, didn't meddle enough to deal with the border, not doing its job. But then when Arizona picks up and does what it has to do, in comes the government meddling with a bunch of lawyers. So it exercises the Republicans in a way in the short term that can hurt Democrats. Final point is long term, though, this country is trending more Hispanic voters. And in the end, this might be the kind of thing, if Democrats are associated with helping Hispanics, that benefits the Democrats in the long term.
But what the lawsuit actually says, I mean, it mentions racial profiling, but its main argument is that the state is undertaking something that's the province of the federal government, that like foreign affairs or making war, immigration and dealing with borders is something only the federal government can do. That's the main argument in the lawsuit. And then you have these other states that Shayla was talking about passing these laws that are much like Arizona's, and you have shaping up kind of a major constitutional battle that to me is sort of reminiscent of the civil rights era, where you had these states doing these things, the federal government telling them they couldn't, and then you have a clash that has to be resolved in the courts.
And speaking of war, the RNC chair Michael Steele got himself in trouble again. Shayla, what do you say?
Well, he was addressing I don't think he thought he wasn't making a formal speech, was
a
talking
group
about
the candidates,
that's
I think.
Right. It was a, potential. I think it was a handheld video camera type encounter that all politicians should worry about now. But he was talking about the war in Afghanistan, was describing it as a war of Obama's choosing, as if the Democrats had decided to prosecute this conflict. And also, I think more troubling to a lot of Republicans was talking about the war as a losing proposition, that questioning the why the U.S. was there to begin with, what we thought we could accomplish there. Now, a lot of people would argue, that's a legitimate point of argument given the history of Afghanistan, the history of conflict in Afghanistan, but not a helpful statement from the head of the Republican Party at a time when President Obama is sending 30,000 more troops into that country and they're trying to stabilize it and Republicans seeming to take sides with liberals who are arguing exactly the same point.
Will he lose his job?
It doesn't look like it. The various people have called for his resignation. Bill Kristol, of the Weekly Standard, has, and he's going to stay probably until his term is up in January.
John Dickerson, chief political correspondent for Slate.com and CBS analyst. We'll take your calls when we come back. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by Saab, for people who have a different perspective on driving. Learn more at saabusa.com. Saab, move your mind. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. From the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and from the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. The U.S. and Russia staged the biggest spy swap since the Cold War. Cuba pledges to release dozens of political prisoners, and suspected al-Qaeda operatives are arrested in Norway. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup with Naftali Ben-David. He's with the Wall Street Journal, Shayla Murray at the Washington Post, John Dickerson of Slate.com and CBS. Here's an email from David in Fort Worth, Texas. Your earlier caller from Rhode Island tells a very poignant story. Why doesn't the president bring people and stories like this to public attention in order to move the debate on unemployment benefits? Naftali.
Well, he has tried to do that. I mean, he has, throughout the course of the debate over the stimulus, tried to bring people out. There may have been a little bit less of that recently. But I think, what he's doing now is something different. He's trying to take the business approach and talk to businesses that have gotten benefits from the stimulus. And I think his feeling is simply that that's where the political center of gravity is right now.
All right. To Detroit, Michigan. Kim, you're on the air.
Yes. It's just I'm calling from near Detroit. We had around 26,000 people from all over the world, very young people, for the U.S. Social Forum recently. And one of the things that was handed out was from the American Friends Service Committee. And the reason I'm calling is because when you were discussing the deficit, there was no mention of the military budget, and that 59% of the overall U.S. budget is devoted to the military. The money that U.S. has spent on nuclear weapons over the last 30 years equals the deficit.
I'm not sure those figures are quite accurate, John Dickerson.
No, I don't think that they're not accurate. The I think what she may be talking about is the percentage of discretionary spending, that portion of the budget that's not entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, and even so, I think it's the numbers, I believe, more in the 40s. Nevertheless, Kim's point is one that a lot of people make. Well, you had an interesting coalition of Barney Frank, Democrat, and Ron Paul, Republican congressman, putting out a plan to reduce defense spending, arguing that commitments for Europe, you know, in terms of protecting European nations, extend the American dollar farther than it can go. And so even if you leave aside the question of Afghanistan and Iraq and the war against terrorists, there is a portion of the military benefit that should be cut. The problem with that is it only gets you part of the way in terms of the larger deficit problem, and that the real issues that have to be dealt with are the entitlements, because those grow each year as the population grows.
Well, and this goes right back to the question of doing the right thing for the deficit versus the reality of the situation. Right now, you have Congress debating at this very moment the defense authorization bill for next year. Democrats want to include about $500 million a year for an alternative engine to a new fighter plane that the Pentagon says is completely unnecessary. The president has issued a veto threat if the bill arrives at his desk with this alternative engine in it, and yet that engine employs thousands of people in the Midwest, in Ohio, in Indiana, in Illinois, right across the heartland.
But the Pentagon says it does not.
But the Pentagon says emphatically it doesn't need it. And yet this is, we relive this drama every single year in a different form.
And I think the caller has a perfectly good point. I mean, if people are serious about reducing the deficit, then things have to be cut across the board, probably. And, you know, whatever you choose, there's a huge coalition of people who stand to benefit either financially or who simply believe in it, that make it very difficult to cut.
All right. To Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning, Arlene. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I love your show.
Thanks.
I'm just curious. I don't hear, for example, if John McCain had been elected in 2008, so that means that there would have been no bailout of GM, no stimulus. Where would we be right now? I just feel like it's very easy to bash, and both sides are guilty of this, but I don't hear concrete examples of, you know, what would have happened if he had been elected and, you know, what the ramifications of that would have been.
How different might the outlook have been?
Well, the Democrats say that it would have been disastrous. And the caller is getting at a central dynamic of the next election, maybe the central one, which is that the Republicans want this to be a referendum on the Democrats and Obama and where the country is now. And the Democrats want it to be a comparison between how they've done and what they've done and what Republicans have done in the past, would do in the future, and might have done had they been elected. And I think it's a good question. It's one of those things that is unanswerable. But again, it goes to the central debate that's happening right now this campaign season.
John Dickerson?
I think that's exactly right. We saw the president, and he's been doing it for the last several months. But the benefit of being the president is sometimes you get to do things and people think they're new each week, which means he gets coverage every time. But he's been framing the debate in terms of, yes, the economy may be improving slowly, but at least it's improving slowly. And if we give the control back to the Republicans, it will go in the reverse. They're the ones who put us in this fix, says the president. And if we put control of Congress back in their hands, they will take the country in the reverse direction.
All right, to Indianapolis. Good morning, Carolyn. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Diane. Good morning, everyone. I'd just like to say just two things, really. First of all, I like to see someone cover a story on the fact that there are so many corporations that made huge profits last year, the year before. To give an example, AT&T made record profits last year, but yet and still they're laying off by the thousands this year. UPS in January, I think it was January 21st, they announced two things. First, that they overmet their net profit, their net expectations for last year. And the second thing was that they were laying off 1,800 people this year. Somebody needs to talk about the fact that we have these huge corporations who have made so much money off of the average American and poor people, but yet and still, they don't care enough about us to know that every job counts right now.
Interesting point, because I think she reflects a lot of this sentiment out there that corporations continue to make huge profits. They continue to lay off people. John Dickerson.
And I'd add another fact that will to her case, which is that corporate profits were up 44% in the first quarter of this year. So
how can you justify this? Is there a justification for the huge profits and the simultaneous or gradual layoffs?
Well, I guess individual companies would say it's because we tightened our belts that we have these profits. The people who care about those profits are the shareholders. The shareholders are happy to see the profits.
So we're making profits for shareholders. We're not, as Carolyn says, worrying about the people who work for us.
I mean, that's how our system works. I don't know that it's ever been different. I mean, companies make these decisions, and sometimes there are, you know, bad consequences for individual people. I think there is a lot of rage at the corporate world right now for things like this, and particularly for companies that benefited or are seen to have benefited from the stimulus funds. And I think we're in a situation now where people are angry at government for not solving the problem. They're furious at business for acting the way it is. And there's just a great deal of dissatisfaction. I mean, I think, you know, businesses would say things have gotten better, but we're still facing an uncertain future. We got to be careful. But, you know, I'm very sympathetic with what the caller is saying. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, understandable frustration.
Capitalism gone awry, Shayla.
It is ironic. I mean, it's sort of like you hate Congress, but you love your congressman. I mean, there are certain sectors that are performing really well. I don't think anybody's mad at Apple. I mean, judging from the lines to buy iPads and iPhones. And so you, I mean, on the one hand, you want the companies that you like to succeed, and you want the one. I mean, there was an interesting story in the paper today about wealthy people defaulting on their mortgages, that there's this sense that you can just walk away from something and be angry and reject. And there's an undercurrent right now that is troubling to a lot of decision makers in Washington. It's why you see so much skittishness among politicians. They're really not sure how to respond to this anger, because there is nothing really proactive you can do that will dampen it.
Nothing?
Well, because ultimately, at the end, you need these corporations doing well. You need them doing well because you need the money in the system. You need them to ultimately hire people. Corporations aren't just mean. They may be not investing as fast as everyone would like. But, I mean, ultimately, if the American business sector gets back on its feet, the economy will get back on its feet.
All right, let's go to Burke, Virginia. Good morning, Zach. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you, Diane. The comment you made about 30 seconds ago suggesting capitalism gone awry, I would actually argue that this is exactly what capitalism is supposed to do. And regarding the gentleman from the Wall Street Journal, I would say, yes, corporations are mean. Corporations are parasitic. And given that it's workers that create value, not the companies that arrange them, I would say that it's up to making sure we protect workers with things like if people are foreclosing on their mortgages and they need bailouts for that, as opposed to bailouts for big financial institutions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Naftali shouldn't get blamed for what I said. I was the one who said that corporations are mean. My point was that that if they see it in their business interest to expand and hire more workers to produce more goods, they won't not do that because they're mean. That was my only point about the meanness of corporations.
Okay, here's a message posted on Facebook from Elizabeth. She says, I'd like to know what sacrifices our politicians are making while we, the people, are asked to make all kinds of sacrifices. My husband is lucky to have a job. After being laid off for 7 months, he works for half of what he made before. Tell me, if the House and Senate are really concerned about the deficit, ask them to take a pay cut. Shayla.
You know, there's an interesting phenomenon. I'm not sure whether it's just anecdotal or not at this point, but some of the governors in the Midwest, Jay Nixon in Missouri, Mitch Daniels in Indiana, Tom Strickland in Ohio, that have made very deep, difficult cuts and have, by all any normal measure, should be unpopular right now, are actually, I mean, I think Jay Nixon's approval ratings in Missouri are around 60%. So there is a way to convey to people that you're willing, that sacrifices mean something and that will ultimately lead us to a better place. I think that politicians in Washington are not effectively communicating that to people in either party, and that's why people think nothing's being done for them, when in fact there are things being done. It's just not resonating.
All right, to Bristol, Tennessee. Good morning, Norman.
Oh, good morning. Glad you took my call. I understand that all these topics that you guys are bringing up, how very important they are, but I don't understand the priorities. I don't know why they're going to be considered that important when we haven't taken into account the misbehavior of a previous administration. There have been no legal ramifications to Bush, Cheney, Rice, and the rest. I don't think any of this makes that much difference to the American public until we all feel like we're treated the same under the law and these people are held accountable.
What do you think of that, Naftali?
Well, I mean, I assume that that's a reference to some of the things that were done during the war on terror. And I know that there are a lot of people that are very concerned about that. The Obama administration has made a calculation that prosecuting people under the previous administration was not a constructive thing to do. There is some frustration about that. I mean, I do think talking about whether or not people have jobs and how they're getting by is something that's important to people. In a way, I'd like to go back a little bit to the previous conversation we had. I mean, I don't know if we can expect companies to act incredibly benevolently. Maybe we should, but it's probably not realistic. It's the government whose job is supposed to be to take care of people. And I think sometimes the government tries, but then people react angrily, and it's a very difficult and complex set of dynamics.
Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I wonder if we have any idea who might fill the seat of the late Senator Robert Byrd, John Dickerson.
Well, I think the current governor would like to be the person to fill that seat. He's not going to do it just yet. There was a question about whether they would have a special election in West Virginia. The current governor, Manchin, said he would wait till the attorney general ruled. The attorney general has now ruled and said there can be the state law permits a special election. So we'll have a special election in West Virginia. First, there will be an appointment. So the governor will appoint someone that will allow the Democrats in Congress to maybe get the votes they need to pass this Wall Street regulatory reform they've been trying to pass. When Senator Byrd died, they lost a Democratic vote. So somebody will be appointed, then there will be a special election in November, and that will go until Senator Byrd's term expires, which is in January 2013.
And the Democrats now have a 59-41 majority. It's a pretty decent bet that they'll lose six or more of those seats. So every single one of these seats is very important.
And tell me about Donald Berwick, the physician who's been appointed to run Medicare and Medicaid, and he was given a recess appointment. Why?
Well, because the president didn't want to engage in another several weeks of debate over things like rationing and socialized medicine, which is exactly what the Republicans were planning to do if his appointment came up. You know, he would be heading the Medicare and Medicaid programs. The president's allowed to appoint him during a recess without Senate confirmation, but Republicans were lying in wait to raise those issues.
And that's exactly right. The White House tried to say, well, we had to rush him and appoint him as a recess appointment because Republicans were going to hold up his appointment. They are doing that in some cases. There are, I think, about 180 people still waiting to be confirmed. But in this case, Naftali's exactly right. They weren't going to hold up the nomination. They wanted to have big hearings, neon lights, and have a huge debate about rationing because Mr. Berwick, who is a pediatrician, has said—
Dr. Berwick.
Dr. Berwick. I don't want to take away any of his degrees. has talked about the trade-offs you have to make in health care coverage. And immediately, Republicans have gone to some of his quotes and articles he's written and said that what he is in favor of is rationing. And that goes back to the member death panels from last summer in August. So they wanted to make him the poster child for rationing government control of your health care decisions, which they hoped would benefit them in the November
elections.
He
also expressed appreciation for the British form of medical help, Shayla.
This was a gutsy move by President Obama. Dr. Berwick is really well known and widely admired in his field, and Republicans know they are being complete hypocrites to a certain extent on this nomination, because he's a serious man who would make, you know, push forward a lot of the changes that everybody agrees needs to happen at Medicare.
And John Dickerson, give me one sentence, will you, on why there was such huge attention to LeBron James?
I have no answer. It was a total ridiculous show. People love basketball. He's a great basketball player. They want to know what he's up to.
Well, he's the biggest star since Michael Jordan. People wanted to know if he'd stick with his hometown or go someplace else and sell his talents.
Any thoughts, Shayla?
I think people are just sick of talking about soccer.
All right. Shayla Murray of The Washington Post, John Dickerson of Slate.com, Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.